gentlemen, welcome back for the first of our plenary sessions. And in these sessions, we have a tradition of inviting eminent scholars in one of the social sciences who have done work related to some aspect of Greece, and who form, in a sense, the punctuation marks between the rest of our proceedings, where you, the PhD students, present your work, and they provide a context and provide some ideas about where your work can be situated, should be situated, and involve you in a dialogue with people who are at the top of their profession. And it's a great pleasure to introduce to you this afternoon Professor Irakis Polymarchakis, who is a professor of economics at Warwick University. He has previously taught at a number of universities in the United States and in Belgium, if I remember correctly. He's taught at Brown and Columbia, educated in the States as well, on the East Coast, if I remember correctly. He has written dozens of articles, and I literally mean dozens of articles, in top economics journals, and if you look at his CV, you'll see that I'm not exaggerating. And he has also, even though he is reticent to admit this, recently acquired a title in the policy-making world as an advisor to the Prime Minister of Greece. So it's a great pleasure that we welcome him to the symposium to speak as one of our two keynote speakers. And he was going to talk on the subject of the debt of nations, but he sort of informed me now that what he'd rather do is talk about the current situation, which I assume is on some of your minds as well. And he would limit his remarks because he wants to encourage a dialogue and a discussion rather than simply a lecture. Professor Polymarchakis.
Thank you very much. Before starting with the talk, short talk, and the discussion, which I would very much like to have, I think it is important to take stock of what's happening right now and where we stand. I think it's important to realize that there is a large number of people, different people to different extents, in different ways, in Greece, who are having a very hard time. And this is something that we should not forget. Two groups stand out. One group is the old pensioners. And I remember a description in a British newspaper last year or 2 years ago concerning the situation in England, but nevertheless, I think it was very nice. It said that they were referring to these people as those who have to choose between heating their places and putting food on the table. And I think the number of people in Greece of old age who face such dilemmas is by no means negligible. And the other group that one should not forget are the young, and there the statistics are depressing. I mean, we hear it as everyday experience from friends and relatives about people who graduate and from high school or college, and they see nothing ahead of them. I mean, they are completely at a loss. And the statistics that came out, I read in the newspaper last week, is that 45 or 50% of people, when they are asked what they want to do, the only thing they mention is they want to leave. That's the only thing that gives them some kind of glimmer of hope. Okay. Actually, what was interesting about it is that they talked about the percentage. That is, how many of those asked say, my first option is to go out, to get out. And whether you ask people who finished the university, or whether you ask people who have been unemployed and are on unemployment insurance, the percentage is the same. Which is it's quite striking. You would expect those who are unemployed and cannot, I mean, you would expect them to be more eager to get out. But those who finished, I understand that there are countervailing influences, but nevertheless, to have 50% of either, these are the two extreme groups of young people, and the only thing they want is to get out. And this type of situation is particularly unnerving when it happens in a Western country, in the 21st, and by Western I mean in the developed world. It happens in the 21st century, where the level of prosperity is quite high. And it's particularly, it's pathetic when Europeans who are supposed to attach high value on human dignity, and they get up in arms when Strauss-Kahn is paraded in front of the police in New York and his rights are being violated. And when old guys run much through garbage to get something to eat, this is something that is to be expected, or I dare say they deserve, because of bad behavior in older times. Anyway, I just wanted to say this because I think I understand this is not an activist conference, it's an academic conference. We're supposed to understand things and not do things, but nevertheless, some things have to be stated. Now, to start with the discussion proper, I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to be here and to ask their indulgence, but apparently they already agreed to it, so I don't have to ask for permission. To ask for their indulgence for not doing what they probably expected me to do, which is to give a long talk, comprehensive or whatever. I don't have a comprehensive statement to make. And I will say a few things and then open the floor for discussion. I think that's the most interesting thing that we could do. So the first question that we can ask is, why did we get here? How did we get here? Now, a friend of mine the other day, who is involved with macroeconomic policy in Europe, he's an academic, but he's very much in moves in policy circles, gave me a very short description of what went wrong or how Greece got where it is right now. He said, forget all the other numbers. You've been borrowing 10% of your GDP for 10 years. Then, you know, this gives you, if you borrow 10 and 10 and 10, this brings you up to 100. So in 10 years, you've borrowed your entire GDP, and if you add interest rates on it, you get where now you can ask if it's 120 or 130 or 145, but this is not the issue. Oh, and by the way, if not only there will be shortly there will be discussion, but if there is any time that you want to say something, please feel free to do so at any time. So why did we get to this stage? Now, I don't think that the reasons or the motives that led people to behave that way were all bad. Now, I remember once a philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, who said that one of the things that we should not forget is that there may be a trade-off between two different goods. The fact that two things are good does not mean that they also don't go against each other. And he gave us an example, he said, bringing up kids. So when you bring up a kid, you want the kid to become self-reliant and do things alone. At the same time, that's a good. It's also good to help the kid when it needs help. So these are two goods which may be going against each other at various occasions. So I think that it's not contradictory what I'm saying. There might have been good intentions and even good motives that led to the situation which we are right now. I mean, don't forget that in 1975, the country came out of a seven-year period of, call it house arrest, whatever you want to call it, the military regime. Now, the military regime, of all the bads that it bestowed, one thing it didn't, and that was debt. Okay, when the colonel's left fell, the debt was at zero. So we started building it up from there. But it was a time that people had to be given freedom. They're not willing to submit to any kind of authority. Income had to be redistributed. And that was, it was done in a bad way. Okay, it was done by borrowing, okay, and giving to people, not instilling what might be considered a conservative or bourgeois attitudes like working hard or being ambitious or being productive. These things were ignored. They became bad words that you wouldn't dare mention. It has occurred to me many times that one of the things that we should have in Greece and we don't have much of is prizes. Just give prizes to people, but be a bit more ambitious, more competitive. This is not something that people strive for anymore. I remember a discussion when I went back to Greece in 2005. I'm looking for my glasses, but I remember, and then I was advisor to Papandreou when he was in the opposition at the time. And I met somebody who belonged to the youth organization of met any of these people, so I wanted to meet them to see what they are like. So it was a strange discussion, because at the end, these people started telling me that the state must provide to every citizen a decent, comfortable life, and any work that you do is for the extras. And that was something they strongly believed in. Okay? And they didn't claim it for themselves. They thought that a good state provides this. So I'm saying these were not spoiled rich kids, these were middle-class kids, and middle-class not in the English sense, you know, working class, whatever. And they thought that a decent government has to provide this. So it's not surprising then that you end up with a debt of larger than your national product per year. Okay. Now, of course, there was corruption. Of course, there were special interests. And put all of this together, I think these more or less explain why, or describe, if not explain, why we got where we are right now. Now, so we are here. The government took over in October 2009, and we appealed to the IMF in April, May 2010. Now, there can be interminable discussions whether there would have been what the government did in that period could have been done better, whether going to the IMF could have been avoided, whether what was done by the Prime Minister, who admitted openly by the corruption that he was facing, or the Minister of Finance talking about Titanics or loaded guns or unloaded guns, I think these are totally secondary issues. I don't think that the fact that we went to the IMF is something that would have been avoided, given how the numbers were progressing. Now, there was also, there is another issue you may raise with the speculators, bad markets, people behaving badly in markets or responsible for what happened. There was a Greek official who mentioned this in a foreign country, let me not be more specific, and he got a very curt answer, which is, this is a lot of crap. Okay, that's what they're talking about. The speculators are not what caused the crisis. Now, let's not be naive. I don't know of anybody who made money out of the crisis. I'm sure there are many. Okay, but there is a difference between saying that there are people who profited by shorting Greek bonds or doing whatever, buying or selling CDSs, and saying that's the behavior of speculators that bankrupted the country. I think these are two different things. As a matter of fact, I think that there is a very important, a very nice book written by somebody from whom I would not have expected it. There is this man called Robert Reich. He even has an article in the FT today about double dip in the US or the recession coming again. And he wrote a book, and I was very surprised, because remember who Reich was? Reich was a professor of labor economics at the Harvard Business School, who was Clinton's first Secretary of Labor. And he was not in the second Clinton administration. He was sort of the left of the Democratic Party in the US, and the second Clinton administration, he was not there. And he wrote a book about capitalism, and to my surprise, Martin Wolf in the FT said it was a good book. And I didn't think these two people think the same way, so I was curious to see what that book was. And he makes, I forget what it's called, but... what's it called?
Supercapitalism.
Supercapitalism, okay. Thank you. So supercapitalism, he makes an interesting point. He said, if a system, what you want the system to do is to have rules and be structured in such a way that even if people pursue their own self-interest, somehow the system works well. You don't want firms to think to be altruistic. I mean, you want firms to profit maximize, but you want the rules of the game to be such that the firms, by being selfish, will lead to the right result. So I think that speculators may have made money out of the situation, but I think it's disorienting to blame the problems the country is in right now to some misbehaving financiers. Right? Okay, so the situation became untenable, the spreads started skyrocketing, and then the decision was made to go and ask for help from the IMF. Now, what does this mean? This means that the instead of borrowing from markets, the IMF and the EU come and they give you the money as opposed to having to borrow from capital markets. Now, realize that the IMF never lends to countries. I think the rule was, see, countries have deposits with the IMF, it's like a bank. So you have deposits with the bank, and then you can, when you need, you go and you take some money out. Usually, I think the upper limit for what they would lend to a country was 200% of their quota. You know what was in the case of Greece? It was 3,200. The amount they gave us relative to what we could have borrowed from the IMF according to the rules. Now, of course, that's why the money did not all come from the IMF. It came 3/4, whatever, from the EU and 1/4 from the IMF. Now, they gave us the money, but the rules, of course, are that they give you the money, they give you the money at a lower rate of interest than the rate at which you would have borrowed it in the market, and much lower given what was happening in capital markets at the time that Greece went to the IMF. But of course, they impose conditions. That's the memorandum. And they impose conditions which were supposed to resuscitate the economy so that at the end of the 3-year period, you can start paying back. Now, the IMF does not give you, when the IMF gives you money, remember, and it's interesting for what's happening these days, actually, the IMF, the decision is taken by the board of directors, which are representatives of the various countries. It's not true that every country has a director. There are fewer directors than countries. For example, Greece does not have a director at the IMF. I think it's the Italian who represents Greece also, serves as a director that represents Greece in the board of the IMF. And it's these people who decide whether to give the money or not. Now, in order for them to decide to give the money according to the rules of the IMF, they must be convinced that at the end of the loan period, you'll be able to start paying back. Okay. And in order to guarantee this, they ask you to take certain policy measures. Now, and now that's the interesting part of the discussion. What is the formula that the IMF is trying to implement? Well, the recipe of the IMF, this memorandum is many, many pages, but the principles are very simple. They say, start spending less, so reduce expenditures and try to increase your revenue. And second, undertake the reforms, the structural reforms, which are necessary for the economy to start to pick up and start producing again, so you can start paying back by the time we go out. Now, there is a problem, I think, with this formula, and I want to legitimately object to the recipe that has been recommended. What is the problem with the formula? Now, I think that the formula has problems at 3 levels. First, there is the distributive issue. Who bears the burden? Now, to be fair to the IMF, when it says, start raising more taxes and start spending less, they don't tell you how to do it. Okay? You have to convince them that the way you propose to do it will work, but they will not that much interfere as to how you do it. Now, if you look at the case of Greece, it is true that the major cuts were to people that were at the low end of the income scale. It was low-level incomes in the public sector and by extension the private sector, and pensions that were cut. Now, when you ask people why they did this, they would say, yes, we understand that this is a problem, but there was no other way to do it. And the argument which is used, which I don't think is correct, I mean, it's not logically correct, is to say, we had to do this because these people are many. It's like telling the poor, to use a simple expression, look, there are not enough rich people to tax, so we have to tax the poor. Now, I think there's a fallacy there, because there is an obvious answer. The obvious answer is yes, if that's the case, then tax the rich first, And if there isn't enough, then go tax the poor. But to say, I'll forget the rich and start taxing the poor because there are many, I think it's simply, it's easier. So this is, yes?
Could you just identify yourself?
Yeah.
Dimitri Skobar, Dimitri from the University of Manchester.
Okay.
Are you convinced that we know for sure who's the poor and who's the rich in Greece?
Yes, I heard the same remark, and I understand what you're saying. When somebody, in older days, people were discussing the issue of tuition in university, and saying that why should somebody who can, whose family, we were talking about undergrads, why shouldn't families pay part of the tuition if the family can afford it? And somebody said, yeah, but this is a joke, because if you go by income tax returns in this country, they don't mean anything. Okay. Yes, I understand this. But those who were, so you can ask your question in two ways. One question is, the ones that were taxed, I mean, to put it very simply, there were very low salaries and pensions that were cut. It was not only the high ones that were cut. Okay? It is not true, according to the, in the new wave of measures that is coming, I think this is not going to be the case. Okay? We have not seen the new measures that are being discussed. We can only hear bits and pieces from newspapers, and apparently the low pensions are going to be protected. Okay? And if I understand correctly, because this has not come out yet either, the analogous memorandum for Portugal, this hasn't come out yet because I think that's not been signed, right? So it's not a public document. But again, there is information circulating about what is in it. And if what I've read is correct, even though it's only journalistic evidence, no salary or pension below 1,500 euros a month will be affected in Portugal. Now, the ones that were affected in Greece were far below that level. Okay. So, if you're asking me now whether those with higher incomes could have been taxed, no, I think it would have been difficult. And I think there are attempts being made, but they have not panned out. Okay. And as a matter of fact, because I did not want to rely on only hearsay evidence, I looked for evidence about the distribution of income as a result of the last, of these very recent measures. And there is a study, there's a man in the Athens University, ASOE, Economics and Business, by the name of Matsangarnis, who has studies on the distribution of income. And it's actually quite interesting because if you look at the distribution, I understand all the problems with measuring distributions of income, what you measure, I understand. But nevertheless, when you see a picture and by whatever measure they use to measure inequality, you see inequality going down like this from 75 onwards. Nevertheless, it starts blipping up. And also, the number of people under the poverty line, and you know, poverty is measured in two ways, in absolute levels and relative to the 60% of per capita income or whatever, this has also gone up by 5 or 10% very recently. So inequality is losing out given these measures. So one is the so one problem with the memorandum is precisely the fact that on distributive grounds it was not well constructed. Maybe there was pressure of time, maybe there was I think what is unfair is to think that either the government or the IMF for that matter were not sensitive to these issues. I think there is a tendency in Greece to badmouth the IMF, and I can be very critical of it, and we'll talk about it in a while, but I don't think that these were, at least the ones that I met, were far from callous or insensitive. This would be very, very unfair. Okay? So one flaw was a distributive. The other is the old debate about Keynesian economics. Okay, this is the old debate whether if you increase taxes and reduce expenditures, you cause a recession, and how can you expect not the deficit not to go, not to have deficits? I mean, how do you expect tax revenue to go up when there is nothing being produced? Okay, And that's a debate that's going on. And as a matter of fact, it would be a very interesting study to try to disentangle. There is lots of discussion about the effectiveness or why the memorandum, the first memorandum, has fallen short of its targets in terms of tax collection, to what extent this is due to the recession, and to what extent it is due to probably the tax collection mechanism, which we know is ineffective. So the question is, to what extent is the failure of the memorandum caused by the memorandum itself? Okay, that's a very interesting question that some student in macroeconomics should try to take apart. But I think these are issues, and also the Keynesian versus more conservative approach, more orthodox approach, we can talk about. I think the major flaw of the memorandum was somewhere else. The major flaw of the memorandum was, before saying this, there was also the part of structural reforms, but what do you mean by structural reforms? I mean, in this period, 75 to 2011, and probably it had started earlier, there were lots of special interest groups that managed to control various markets in the Greek economy. This can be closed professions. Okay, that's to give one example. These are sort of structural deficiencies that have to be improved, to be cured, to be controlled in some way for the economy to function well. Now, whether the government has another criticism is that the government has not proceeded fast enough or effectively enough in this direction. Okay. Now, I think it has not. I hear that as far as the closed professions go, the important ones were the pharmacists, the lawyers, the notaries, very little has been done in terms of their closed shop situations. This may or may not be the case. I'm afraid it is the case. I think it's a strong criticism of the government that one can make on this level. But I don't think this is what's causing the memorandum to malfunction right now, because these structural reforms would have taken time to be effective. I don't think that even if these professions had been liberalized, we would have seen output increase right now. I think this is not the case. I know that there are studies by Iove, Sturnara, saying that GNP will go up by 7%, whatever it is, if we manage to open up all the professions. I don't know when this 7% is supposed to occur. I don't think it occurs from one day to the next. So the flaw of the memorandum is precisely this. The flaw of the memorandum is to say, okay, you have a public sector which is ineffective, we agree, and it's big. Now, and there are all sorts of structural deficiencies in the economy. Let's take all this for granted. Now, let's suppose that we shrink the public sector, and let's suppose that we correct the structural problems as fast as possible. It is still a statement of faith that as the public sector shrinks, the private sector is going to jump in and fill in the gap. And I think this is nonsense. Okay? There are discussions explicitly in this country, in England, this is not happening. Okay? Let alone a situation like Greece, where the public sector was much bigger. Okay? So the public sector did manage probably to suffocate the private sector, I understand this, but this does not imply that once the public sector shrinks, immediately there will be a hyperactive private sector that will jump in and take its place. Now, you see, I want to make a parenthesis here, and I remember a very nasty remark by Stiglitz many years back when he was working for the World Bank, wherever he was, before going to the Council of Economic Advisors. And the nasty remark he made is that these organizations like the World Bank, the OECD, the IMF, are that the people who work there are the bottom of the class of good universities. Okay? So one gets that impression, in the sense that these people have a very orthodox, very narrow view of what economics says, which economics does not say. Okay, for people who understand economics, good economics doesn't make this claim. And I'll tell you what is the problem that they make. What is the problem? You see, economic theory, if you want, says that if you have perfectly operating markets, the results that you get are good in the sense that up to issues of distribution, in terms of efficiency, of waste, no planner could improve upon. That's the if you want to mention one claim which describes what is the foundation for the belief that market economies work best, is precisely this argument. That if you have a well-functioning market, there is no way to improve upon it. No matter how powerful, how intelligent a planner you had, okay, he could not do better than the market. But this result, which, as I said, is the foundation, the belief in markets is based on this result. If you want to find a two-line reference for this faith in market, is precisely this argument. This result has a major flaw, which has been known for a long time. You see, it is the case, indeed, and it's more or less a theoretical argument, it's purely theoretical. The rest is just extensions, okay? That you cannot improve, if markets work perfectly, there is nothing you can do that is going to be better. What is not true is that if markets are almost perfect, you will get something which is almost as good as you can get. You see, it's a subtle distinction. It's like having a system which, if it works perfectly, it works very well. It works as well as any system. But if there are glitches here and there, the system may yield very bad results. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? It's not an argument which says perfect markets are perfect and almost perfect markets are almost perfect. That's not true. The economic theory never said this. Okay? As a matter of fact, there was a very clever reference to this argument that I'm making right now by Lucas. Lucas was a great believer in markets, okay? Bob Lucas, Chicago. And he talked once about the Tolstoy theorem of welfare economics. Now, nobody associated Tolstoy with welfare economics, you understand? They're not an economist. So he said people were kind of curious about what is the Tolstoy theorem on economics. And Lucas said, yes, if you read the first line of Anna Karenina, the first line is that a good marriage, all good marriages are the same, but every bad marriage is bad in its own way. So he said, when it's a good situation, we understand it, and there are things in common between all good situations, so we can go from one to the other, and draw lessons from one and apply them in the other. But when the situation is bad, it is not, bad situations are not similar to each other. They are bad in their own way. So if a market does not work well, okay, it may yield very bad results, and it's very difficult to draw conclusions about a badly working market and apply them to another imperfectly working market. So the IMF either believes that you are going to go to a situation where Greece or any other market economy for that matter is going to be some textbook example of a free market economy, or they are making a mistake. And the mistake they are making is that if we are in imperfect situations, and I'm sure they will agree that we are in imperfect situations, then you have to intervene somehow. There are policy interventions that are required for the market, the imperfect market, to work as well as its imperfections allow. And the IMF pays no attention to this. It is supposed to come from it's a deus ex machina that will, the day the public sector disappears, market forces will come in and a revival will occur. And I think this is not going to happen, and I think the IMF is very aware of this at this point, of the fact that once the program is over, where the corrections, where the, now the, they will say the growth, I can call it growth, the growth is a catch-all for everything, where growth will come from is not clear at all. And if you look at the, predictions they were making when they gave them aid in 2 years ago, it was simply an assumption that once the public sector shrinks, growth will pick up because the private sector will come in and will correct the situation. And that, yes. In the deficit was less than the memorandum had predicted or hoped for 2010. Okay, but the reduction was important. Okay, and there were also corrections midstream which were not known when the memorandum was written. So, as far as the implementation of the deficit reduction in year one, 2010, is concerned, the memorandum worked, more or less. You can call it more, you can call it less, okay? I'm not, okay. Unemployment is behaving worse than the memorandum predicted, but not that much, okay? So on these two, that's why I said the macro variables, the memorandum, now, the structural reforms were not implemented as fast as the memorandum had prescribed. My objection to this was the fact, was to say that yes, this is true, but I don't think, and this may explain if in the long run the memorandum fails, why it failed, but I don't think that you can attribute the short-term failure of the memorandum to the fact the structural reforms have not been fast enough, quick enough.
But what is the short-term failure?
Okay, right, so what is the short-term failure? The short-term failure is the fact that we cannot, the hope was, is the reaction of markets and that Greece will not be able to enter the, to borrow on its own in 2012.
But that's not the failure of the memorandum, that's the,
well,
the insane way with which the markets operate.
Well,
the failure of the memorandum, in other words, would have been far more visible to me, at least.
Yeah.
If say that the recession target overshoot by a mile, or the unemployment rate was shot by overshot by a mile. In other words, if somebody was able to prove
the
memorandum
it's about
drowned the Greek economy more than it anticipated, because
yes,
the project was all along to drown it a little bit.
Yes, I don't think this is the case. Okay, I think that the macroeconomic targets, as I said, are worse than the memorandum had predicted, but they are not a drowning as opposed to, yes. Now, if you think that the market, I mean, it was part of the goal of the memorandum, however, that markets would be convinced that there would be that the economy is doing well, that the economy is viable, and that we would be able to borrow after the end of the 3-year borrowing from the IMF. And that doesn't seem to be the case. That's why there is a need for a second memorandum right now. Okay. Now, I just want to add two things. You may ask, what should have been done? See, there is a logic that confuses me with the memorandum. And it's not economics, it's simply, it's thinking on first principles. I mean, you have a business that's not doing well, okay? To take a very concrete example, you have a travel agent who has not, has not introduced IT, he's still working with telephones and books and sends clerks to bring and sell tickets, and he's not doing well, okay? So in order to pay the rent and pay the employees, they keep borrowing money. Okay, and at some point, the banks stop lending to them. Okay, now what do you say to these people? You can say close down. Okay. Now that's not an option that is being contemplated, I think, or even if it's contemplated, I think it's being discussed. Okay. Now, I'm saying something very simple. If you tell these people to cut expenses, they will never be able to pay back their debts or restart their business. Okay. It's a banal thing to say, but you need one more loan to buy PCs to start a business that works. So you need, there was an article in the newspaper recently saying that what Greece needs is a Marshall Plan. Is somebody to come and invest, somehow being guaranteed that his money will not be wasted. Okay? And the economy will do better and will be able to pay back its debt. Otherwise, it cannot work. I mean, it's a very obvious thing to say, but I don't think that anybody is willing to put that money in. So, as far as restructuring is concerned, I think 160% of GDP is untenable, but it's not something that Greece should think about right now, okay? Because for the next 3 years we are covered, but until 2012, the current loan from the IMF will work, and I think there will be another loan. I understand there are problems. There are problems because at the IMF there are objections. There are problems because Europe cannot get its act together. And I think it will be another postponement. Okay, because you realize what has to happen now. For some reason, the IMF, and that's because and Strauss-Kahn was helpful there, so the fact that he's not there is a problem, needs to be convinced that at the end of 2012, there will be a Greece will be able to pay back, to start paying back the IMF. Okay, now this is not going to be the case. Okay, so if there is going to be a continuation, Europe must participate. So the IMF board now says we will not pay the fifth installment, whatever it is, unless we have guarantees from Europe that they will put in the money that is necessary after 2012. Now, it is too short for Europe to give a guarantee in black and white, but it's going to, so I think the compromise is going to be there will be some kind of decision in this Council of Heads of State at the end of June, which will not be in black and white, but somehow will be convincing enough for the IMF board to consider it as a promise, and they will pay the fifth installment, and then the discussion moves to September, and when the sixth installment has to be paid. Now, realize that the problem, the haircut situation is not easy. You know, the fact that if Greece restructures its debt, and by restructuring we mean pay less than it owes, I think it's sufficient to say that the ECB has 130 billion Greek bonds, worth of Greek bonds in its vaults. Okay? Now, take a simple argument. If this is reduced by 50%, this means the ECB has a capital loss of 65 billion euros. Okay? You know what's the capitalization of the ECB? 70. So if Greece restructures by has a haircut of 50%, this means all the capital of the ECB is lost and has to be recapitalized. So it is not an easy prospect to manage. Okay, but 160% of GDP is not a manageable debt, because even at 5%, okay, this means that you have 8% interest payments every year, which is a portion of the budget that cannot be sustained. So something will have to be done, but this will have to be done in 2-3 years' time. Okay, I think for the moment the important thing is some kind of injection of funds, of investments that will kickstart the economy, okay, and that will attract and will get the private sector going to replace this defunct public sector which is being replaced. Now, how this can be done, whether it will be done, I don't know.
Thank you very much. There is, I see some hands already, so we just move straight on. Please, could you identify yourself?
Hello, my name is Kalios Evangelos from the University of Crete, part of political science. Well, although I'm an economist and I don't have any further knowledge on that issues, I have realized, especially in the Greek case, that the main problem is state failure. I mean that we try to solve and understand that we identify the problem in Greece by using, let's say, the Ireland example, which is basically market failure there.
Mm-hmm.
In Greece, we don't have market failure because in practice we never have market in terms of a capitalist system.
But
so
in Ireland, the banking failure.
The banking, but in terms of private sector, I mean.
Right.
So somehow it's a market failure.
I assume, when I said banking, it was a private sector bank.
But in the state of Greece, we have a state failure. In terms of justice, let's say, sector,
mm-hmm.
and also the institutional sector of Greece, especially on the investment framework.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools that they are trying to implement are basically economic tools. Although
No, why do you say this? The structure of the reforms are not economic tools.
Why?
Okay, tell me the kind of measures that.
Let's say the Kalinkat reformation.
Yes.
Is a policy measure,
mm-hmm.
that is held by the Greek government without the direction, let's say, of IMF or EU. And
right.
Although it's a significant policy tool to solve the state failure, which is the main problem,
mm-hmm.
the policy measures that IMF and EU underline to Greece are mainly financial measures. That's why I'm saying that. They don't pay any attention, let's say, to the institutional changes we need to take.
No, but yes, but there are measures, no, I don't disagree, but there are measures which are in between. I mean, take this issue of the closed professions.
Yeah.
That's what, I thought by economic measure you mean whether the VAT increases or not. Okay, that's the extreme version of a pure, let's say, economic measure. Where there are intermediate measures like the closed professions. Okay? Now, I think that the measures you are talking about, I don't think they underestimate them. They simply, they cannot do everything. I mean, they let the Greek government do some things on its own as well. I mean, I don't. You are saying that you think the Kallikratis reform is good?
Well, somehow it's better than the one we had before in terms of pressing cost.
Is that true, by the way?
I don't know exactly if it's true.
I'm not sure it's true at all. I mean, in the short run, I'm not sure at all. But
it lasts for 5 months now, so we cannot have a concrete result.
Okay.
But in terms of policy transfer,
mm-hmm.
of course, the political capability, especially on the regional sector,
yeah, of course, yeah.
Much better, especially after July, where the fourth EU-funded program will take place in the region. So I mean that the fourth EU-funded program is somehow like 15 billion
mm-hmm.
euros, which is a quite great amount of money. And the many weaknesses that the policy measures will face are basically institutional.
So give me an example. I don't know anything about it. What is it? Give me an example of what. I think that's interesting. So you're telling that we owe money to somebody who you don't owe. Am I right? That would be the claim.
No, the case of Ecuador is exactly the same.
I'm sorry, say it again?
The case of Ecuador, have you heard of it?
No. Of Ecuador, I've heard, not of that case.
So
I mean, that's not. That's a wonderful thing. This week. No, I think that's is the government doing it?
No.
I think that's.
No way, because the idea behind it is that politically it is responsible for that.
Yeah.
They let money in the name of the big citizens without informing them.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, believe me, I'm with you. I agree with that. I'm not. Yeah.
Outside Athens, usually. Not about Athens or the periphery, but it's usually
they do is they have the world patent and they use olive oil import. The patent in the States worth 100 million. So if they close right now with Steve, they can still get their revenues just from the patent. These are some examples. And I can give you lots of different sectors, minerals.
So what, sorry,
but it's
so
oil.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Okay.
What's the point?
Oil.
So
the point is these arguments are correct. That's what he's saying.
No, I'm just saying that. Don't you think that in your analysis you should incorporate some thought, meaning you, not a general person in general, because, I mean, because we discussed about the debt and the status in Greece, what is happening with the microeconomics of specific businesses, private, semi-private, or cooperatives, that are quite extrovert,
right,
in different sectors?
Now, that's very interesting. Are you saying that this, I thought we were talking about the memorandum as our object of criticism, and assessment of the memorandum, okay? So are you saying that the memorandum or the complex of policies that the memorandum contains has ignored this source of,
yes,
or has that made things worse? I mean,
yes, because it deprives, especially the rhetoric, not exactly the actual measures, more the rhetoric, deprives some efforts that are quite important in different places in Greece.
So I don't understand this argument now. In what sense does the fact that the memorandum is open, the policy of the memorandum are operating, how does it hurt these firms?
That's why I'm saying the rhetoric, not exactly the policy, meaning that there is a specific delay in all the returns that those companies get to take from creating that, you know.
Okay.
For example,
yes,
for some of them it's vital.
I couldn't agree more.
For some of them.
Yes.
So, on the other hand, the effort of the people at this age, people in the universities, people in farms, is deprived because they can see their products being affected in different markets, competitive, and they cannot take in a way the mental and the ethical satisfaction that this is operating, and so we can showcase those parts as an example, as a paradigm shift.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think, I don't know what to say, but I think that's what you say is very important, it's very good. I mean, the question is whether there are policies that the government or whoever could undertake to make the lot of these people and their operations even better. That's the question, am I right?
Yes, it is.
That's exactly, I couldn't agree more.
Please.
I have a different question regarding
your name, please.
The question is not one which is left only at one level. There are multiple audiences here, and decisions that had to be made at multiple levels to serve different kinds of interests.
Friendly and bad, that I'm better off on my own, okay? Or on my own, or with whoever is going to talk to me after that. What makes you think that that was the best? But what makes you think that there was no better way out than what Argentina went through?
Very energy for financial sort of restitution. We're kicking the can down the road. If we reach the point where we say, yes, we've stabilized the diseased person there, and now we are on the road to recuperation.
No.
We are still, and this uncertainty keeps hurting. We're still kicking the can. And
but what's the alternative?
We are pushing the,
I understand what this means, but.
Yeah, and we are amassing more and more debt. There's another 60 billion coming, which will need to be paid.
It's not another 60 billion. It's 60 billion that will pay 60 billion worth of all debt. That's a mistake, I think, to assume that the 60 billion we're going to get will be additional debt. It is debt that will repay previous
will
debt.
Will replace.
In the same way that
yes,
110
yes, yes.
billion. That
yes,
paid.
Yes, of course.
Was not
okay.
additional
okay.
debt.
All right.
debt
okay.
that repay debt.
Yes.
And a little addendum about this. Privatization.
This committee.
Well, the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little skeptical. I'm not ideologically against privatizing state companies, particularly state companies that are run by.
Yes, but I am. But I'm sick and tired of this privatization.
Yes.
It's a panacea for everything.
May I add the additional skepticism that they are going to be privatized dirt cheap. They're going to essentially what? Cover financial.
Why should we privatize dirt cheap?
Equity prices are low.
You know that there was the other day, it was quite sad, but there was a, 2 or 3 days ago, there was an article in the FT saying, have you heard West Side Story?
Yes.
No, but you listen to West Side Story, there's one of the songs, the girl, Maria, whatever, says, I bought the washing machine, and somebody answers, but what have you got to get clean? So it was exactly quoted on the BBC the other day. I don't think they realized they did this, because they said they were reading the headlines, you know, in the morning show, whatever, they read the headlines of the newspapers, and there was an FT headline which said, Greece up for sale, and one of the two announcers read this, and the other responded, but what is there to buy? Okay? So that's what you are saying, that we are going to sell things that are worth nothing.
No, I think there is quite a lot to buy, and in fact, I am a little mystified, I must say, with this insistence by the Germans and the French, frankly. There's the ITER, there's utilities, airports.
Okay, you want my answer on this?
I'll tell you what I think.
It's
key to buy, because it's going to be dirt cheap, because there's not going to be any regulatory framework, no structures, and it's frankly not going to solve any problems. 2 years down the line, and there will not be anything to sell.
My only answer to this is that I wish I could convince myself that they are corrupt. I think they're simply dumb. I mean, I would rather deal with a corrupt person who's intelligent than an ideologue that you cannot communicate with. And I don't think that they want these privatizations because they want to buy Greece on the cheap. This thing is being discussed, okay? That there are all these banks, these resources that they're going to buy for nothing. And that's why they want it. I'm sure it crosses people's minds, okay? But I think this mantra about privatizations is something that everybody has learned and they repeat it. And there is no more. And the two work together, okay? I'm not. But I have my own reservations about privatizations. I couldn't agree more.
Okay, we're running out of time, and there's a number of people who want to ask a question. So I'm going to take you all, there's about 5 of you, and then we'll allow Professor Polymathakis to answer those bits that he wants to answer. We'll start right at the back.
Has been taken into account. If this is the case, what will happen to the economy
I know that there are lots of, it has been tried in the past to have people from abroad, whatever money has been taken out, to come back in. I think that this is not going to be, I don't think it's going to be easy, okay? And it's a particular situation where I wouldn't mind it, because I think that the money that's coming back, I mean, this operation is not necessarily legitimizing money laundering. In this particular instance, there were people who were afraid and they took their money out. So I think it's perfectly legitimate to try to attract it and bring it back. There had been attempts in the past to bring back money that was earned in dubious ways. And I must say that I may be naive, but I was always very reluctant to be in favor of such projects. Anyway, these people, the ones that were going to use this money laundering, I mean, to legitimize money laundering, I think they don't trust the Greek state, so they wouldn't, they would never do it. It's a bit like, I was in America when Bin Laden was killed, and somebody, there was a talk show, and somebody said, "Do you think the Pakistanis knew about Bin Laden?" And the guy said, the American official said, "Of course they didn't know. If you were Bin Laden, would you trust the Pakistanis to know where you are?" I mean, so it's not a matter. Of course. No, I think that if you ask what I would recommend, I don't want to avoid this question. I think what has to be done is to have a serious to think about alternatives to the policies that the memorandum recommends, and bring them up either with the Troika or their bosses. And I don't think that this is something beyond hope. I think the concerns that we expressed here, I don't think these people are, I don't want to be naive about them. I criticized them and I said that they are behaving in very simplistic ways about attacking the problem. But I think they're perfectly willing to discuss, and I think one has to think hard about ways to redress the situation and bring up as alternatives to the memorandum, and I think that's exactly what has to be done.
And what about the question about we've had enough?
Yes, we've had enough, and there are, the streets are full of people every night. I have not been there. I don't know how serious this movement is, but from the few people I know who go around in policy circles, I think they're taking it very seriously. I think they take it more seriously than I would have expected, to be honest.
Okay, let's take a very last group of questions here.
Yeah. I think that there have been delays in these measures, but I'm saying that I don't think that these are, I don't disagree with what you say for the medium run. I think as far as the very short run is concerned, I don't think this was the problem, but the delays have slowed down, and that's the problem. It's very difficult for me to predict what's going to happen in the next few months. I think the situation is very, very fluid politically right now. I don't know what's going to happen. I think that if the memorandum, if the association with the IMF and so forth continue, I think that they will definitely be moving in that direction. They have moved in that direction. It's a matter more of implementing rather than legislating. The problem with the memorandum is that very often, because you cannot do everything, so they pass general laws, but of course the implementation is in the details, and these details are the implementation is very often left to ministerial decrees, and that's where things start getting murky. Saying, where do we find the resources? That's the problem.
Dimitris, last question.
Last, right, okay. Just to go back to the earlier idea of Professor Polymarchakis, that is, a lot of us are here to understand what is the forces behind the problem and what are the possible ways forward. I think there are two issues, in my opinion, that we need to keep in mind. One is the point about causality. In other words, we know that it's hurting, we know it's hard, but are we 100% sure that we can allocate blame with certainty? And who is to be blamed? The second point that is really important, I think, is the issue of temporality. And that is to say, when do we act in order to move forward? And of course, what to do with it, depending on the causality. The debate at present in Greece reminds me very much of the Greek football team in the 1980s, when they were 1-0 down before halftime and they gave up. They said, we're going to lose, that's it, we're dead. Start thinking who to blame. Is there perhaps a point to make here that we need to toughen this out, we need to wait a little bit longer? We are only into this for a year. It hurts,